I'd like to call the work group together. This is the interim work group for the alternative school assessments. And I'd like to begin by reading a little recap of the things that we have covered in the work group so far. So I'll begin with that. That's just an announcement that they will be testing some of the fire alarm system here, and I see that they have covered up the strobes in this room, so hopefully they won't be too much of a distraction. This work group was prompted by House File 1799, which called for Minnesota Department of Education and Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, along with the Office of Educational Accountability, which was not funded in the last session, to develop and present to the House and Senate Education Committees recommended indicators that fairly and accurately measure progress of alternative students and schools, and that avoid negative and unintended consequences of the high-stakes tests. In addition, the work group was formed to offer legislators better understanding of unique issues alternative programs face. The interim work group was briefed on the criteria that places students in ALCs and charter schools that choose to serve those students. The criteria include such life-challenging situations as homelessness, parenting abuse, delayed academic achievement, etc. The committee also heard from two alternative staff, Jody Nelson and Sherry Graff, who explained the conditions of entering students, interventions attempted by the alternative schools, and the negative impact and non-informative nature of the high-stakes test. Alternative schools are unique in their visions and missions directed at student needs, making them unique and difficult to assess by restrictive MCLB tests and measures. The work group was presented with three position papers by the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs on AYP, high-stakes tests, and multiple measures, all dated 2003 to 2004, demonstrating a history of concern about school improvement. MAP also mentioned a lack of meaningful involvement on the part of MDE to engage with professionals in the field on ways to improve educational delivery other than the framework presented by MCLB. The Department of Education explained that alternative testing may be created, but that it would be expensive and would need to be applied to all Minnesota schools. There are no discussions at this time about alternative assessments for alternative schools. The committee also heard testimony from Dr. Wayne Jennings about brain-based research and its implication to learning. All students learn at different rates and in different ways, and threatening life situations negatively impact efficient brain operation and academic learning. Different learning situations like problem-based, open inquiry, team-based, and community involvement are helpful in mentally engaging youth in alternative programs. Testimony was presented by Dr. Cheryl Lang on the importance of timely measurements of student progress and the detrimental impact of one-time high-stakes tests. A synopsis of the limited research done on alternative schools was given and found wanting in telling the true impact of alternative programs on student progress. Due to No Child Left Behind emphasis on core academic areas, there are scarce resources to create meaningful accountability methods for alternative programs. Minnesota Department of Education presented some answers to the work group's inquiries, reporting on MCA scores, demographics, numbers attending. There were a number of conflicting figures and much data is not tracked, such as mental health, chemical dependency, student program tenure, breakdown by criteria, graduation numbers, and postgraduate status. Two ALC and one contract school director, Julia Gillick, Steve Allen, and Fred Easter, gave a synopsis of the issues they face, how their programs attempt to meet student needs, and the lack of telling data and resources they face in working to improve their programs. Testimony was also presented on quality management concepts, emphasizing the non-informative nature of MCLB process testing, high-stakes tests, and the value of leading and formative data to determine student outcomes. It was also noted that skills and knowledge in data determination, analysis, and process improvement are not taught in teacher and administrator college preparation courses. That concludes the the little report I have about what we've been talking about. If there are, if other members would like to either add or comment in what I said, you can feel free to do that. Okay. We have this evening three presenters who will talk to us about systemic measures for accountability and different things that, alternative programs might try to better understand the progress of their students. On the original agenda, Mark Van Rysen was going to go next, but was going to go first, but due to some commitments, we'll have Dr. Cheryl Lang come forward and speak to us. Yeah. Introduce yourself for the record, and then.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Cheryl Lang, and I am a founder of a research and evaluation firm, Lang Research Evaluation, located in Bloomington, Minnesota. And I'm very pleased to be here today. Thank you all, thank you, Chair, for asking me to return. I would like to just note that since I did testify a month or so ago, I want to make sure that I'm not repeating everything, but at the same time, I believe it is important to at least touch on a few of those areas that I did discuss the last time, and make sure that we have time for questions this time. I think that is something that we ran out of in October. Just a brief background for those of you that may not have been at the last meeting. I have been a classroom teacher. I've been a researcher at the University of Minnesota, and I have my own research firm for the last 10 years. Since approximately 1990, I've done research on school choice options, including charter schools, open enrollment, post-secondary enrollment options, homeschooling, alternative schools, and our high school graduation and high school incentives act, and so, or HSGI. And so I've touched on each of these during the course of that time, and most of the research has been looking at how you determine whether or not these programs are being successful. In all cases, we were looking at outcomes for students. That is a perfect match with looking at accountability, be it an NCLB or any other type of accountability system. But one of the things that ties all of the research that I've done over the years, whether it was at the university or with various other entities around the country or specifically for organizations, one of the things that ties that together is the need to be looking very carefully and specifically at the missions of those various laws and those various programs that result from those laws, and then making sure that you actually are taking into account how they may differ from the traditional programs. Because in all of those cases that I mentioned, the way that education is delivered is somewhat different than our traditional model. And so I think that is how I want to introduce my comments, because I think it's important that as you look at alternative schools specifically, that there's an understanding that those of us that have looked at outcomes over the years have found that there are nuances that are going to help not only educators but policymakers make better decisions about these programs, and that our current system does not allow for those nuances. And that I think it's very important, if we're going to meet the needs of students, that we do so. So I do appreciate being here. Some of the findings and some of the projects I just want to touch on briefly again. During the 1990s, I was involved with a project with Dr. Jane Feifeldijk at the University of Minnesota, where we received funding from the U.S. Department of Education Office of Special Education Programs. We looked specifically at students with disabilities, but always had a comparison group of students without disabilities. So all of our research was applicable to both students with and without disabilities. In those cases, we looked at CSEO, HSDI, and charter schools and homeschooling. We used multiple measures to inform what we learned through that project. In fact, in one case, when we were looking specifically at Minnesota's alternative schools, we looked at and had a comparison group between students who had similar characteristics going to traditional high schools and those attending alternative schools here in Minnesota. We believed at that time, and I still believe today, that the importance of multiple measures cannot be overstated, because we have students who are coming into those programs with specific needs. They choose to come into those programs in most cases because the other system has likely not met their needs. Therefore, they are often designed in a manner that isn't traditional. And to understand whether or not the students are reaching the kinds of goals and outcomes we want, we have to look at it in a multifaceted fashion. And that is what we did in that study, and those results are published. In 2002 and 2007, we conducted a literature review of alternative schools and programs around the country. We found at that time, in 2002, and again now, that there are very few research projects around the nation that can get a good handle and give us what we would call sound empirical results around outcomes for students who attend these schools. I have my own theories as to why that might be the case. I think one reason, as was noted in the introduction, may be that the emphasis has gone so strongly these last years to NCLB. But I think also one of the things that we had to do in our work is to actually have a different type of permission and human subject permission, because the students are often do not have the same connection, or they may not have the same connection. And so it's difficult to get data, because if you had to ask a parent and so on, it was difficult. So we had something called passive. They could opt into the project without having to have a proactive sign-off from their parents, and that made a huge difference. I bring that up because as you're looking at an accountability system, some of these things come through the state, and what it's going to allow is information not only, if you look at it slightly differently here in Minnesota, for the Minnesota schools, but it will have a great impact, I believe, nationally, if you do design a system that comes through the state and the conduit there, because we'll have data to get a much better understanding of these programs as well as others. In the early 2000s, I was part of a study out of the University of Minnesota that was a project investigator with Dr. Tammy Lear, and we both worked on developing a topology of alternative programs around the nation. Findings from that study indicate that many of the programs slip through the cracks in terms of accountability, largely because the data are not across the nation disaggregated or identified specifically for alternative programs, even though the delivery of those programs is very different. Our review in 2007 found that many of the articles being written now are really addressing what, in several of the articles that we reviewed, was a dropout rate that they considered to be around 30%. I know Minnesota's is not considered to be that high, but that is what is in the literature, and I know there's a huge amount of controversy about what the actual number is. But in any case, it's too high. And so a lot of the accountability or the alternative literature around the alternative programs is asking whether or not we really are addressing, and the program's addressing, some of those types of information to the extent that it should be. There's a great deal of criticism in the literature that the current accountability system that is as more rigid as NCLB does not allow to gather the information that's salient to addressing these programs or these students. So that brings me to the research that we've done is in three states, here in Minnesota and two other states. We actually, over the course of the years, I would say about 2005, 2006, we're looking at 28 programs that serve several thousand students in another state, and we were hired by a private entity to take a look at that information, and unfortunately it will not be published as it is internal to that, for that organization. But what we learned was something not exactly new to us. And what we learned in trying to determine whether or not those programs were successful was that we really had to do several things. Number one, we had to have multiple measures. Number two, those measures had to be across not only academics but other areas that were specific to students who were coming and accessing those programs. For example, retention, obviously graduation, but also social and emotional areas that if these programs were to be successful, they often had internal programs around that, those types of characteristics, but no one was measuring whether or not they were successful. The other thing is that, as I mentioned the last time, I call the temporal nature of gathering this information. We cannot, if you are going to really understand whether or not Minnesota schools that serve these students are successful, cannot do it on a one-time basis. It's not going to work. And I'm going to give you a couple of things from another study that we just completed this last winter to give you some context, and I probably mentioned some of this last time, but I want to repeat it. In this particular state, in March was their state testing. In that The day of state testing, 38 students out of the 258 were present for testing that were enrolled that quarter. However, for that year, there were several hundred that had been enrolled in that school. If I'm in your shoes, I would not be wanting to base the success of that school on 38 students. But that was the day of NCLD AYP testing, and that was where it was at. However, when we went in and used a model that looks at slices of student enrollment over time, we were able to get a much better handle on whether or not the students were demonstrating growth. Number one, we made sure that they had a growth type of academic assessment that was part of their program. But number two, that had to be tied to many different things. It wasn't just that you were going to look at whether or not they were making academic growth, but how did that differ in terms of their attendance? How did it differ in terms of how long they stayed in the program? We cut and sliced and diced the data many ways, and as a result, those programs have a very accurate idea as to whether or not they are succeeding with their program, and I can tell you that they're a little worried. But frankly, and are putting in some interventions to address that. What are some other areas? For example, in these two schools that we looked at in another state, they, over the course from fall 2004 to June 2007, okay, so approximately 3 years, have served approximately 1,200 students. Okay. During that time, they had 43 students graduate. Okay. When you went back in and you looked at the records, it looked very different. Now, that may look very different if enrolled in the spring, 150 kids and 80 so many enrolled are graduating. But when you take the data and you look at it in a temporal manner, what you're able to do is you're able to ferret out where the success is and where it isn't. On the same manner, we were able to take a look at where the students were when they entered the program. Not just an AYP measure, but what happens when you say you need to gather certain information upon entrance. What happens upon entrance when they come? Because these programs are dealing with students that may be reading at a third or fourth grade level but are 17 or 18. If no one is documenting that, then whether or not they actually pass the test or the state test, be it here or in another state, for AYP, the context of that becomes very different. So what we did is we said, okay, perhaps they aren't graduating those kids. What might be some of the reasons why that is? We looked back and we found that, I'll see if I can find it quickly. That Well, 31% of them had only 11 credits when they came in. That would be one thing, so that's looking at that differently. But a very, very high percentage, and it's somewhere in my notes here, were not at the eighth grade level when they entered the program. So that in this particular state, they have to pass a very high standards test, then they aren't at the eighth grade level when they often are entering, then that's going to have an impact. So how do you gauge success? And we come back to several things. You have to look at multiple measures to determine what it is that you really believe these programs should be doing, not only academically, but in other areas of the student's life. What is it that may have an impact on a student that will result in lifelong learning? It doesn't happen now, later. Because one of the things that we found is that oftentimes the students that attend programs such as these, and this has been across three states that we've studied, is they enroll in the programs multiple times. And we find that there appears to be some and very slight evidence that that there is more success in the second or third time of their enrollment. Okay? So does that mean that if you just look at the data, perhaps from the first enrollment, you might get a skewed impact of the program itself? Because maybe it is at the second or the third time that the student actually grabs on. But if that's the success of that program, how do you gauge that? So that idea of temporal and also taking the data over and disaggregating it in many different ways. And I think there are a series of characteristics that I think are key to that. So if you're looking at accountability, that may sound complicated, but I truly do not believe that it has to be that complicated. I do believe in this day and age that we can come up with a system that will address those areas. The back to the issue of where they were in eighth grade, of these students, less than half of them for whom we had data scored at or above the eighth grade reading level, and less than 15% of them scored at or above the eighth grade level in math. If we stick to a one measure one time, we're not going to get any information that is of any value, and it isn't any value to the educator, it isn't any value to the program to determine whether or not it should continue or not, and it isn't any value to the legislator and policymaker that has to make decisions around funding. So these three studies for me, as well as the work we have done in all of our literature review, convinced me that we really have to look at accountability in a different way, and that one of the reasons we have to do that is not just the idea of accountability, that we all have to be accountable for the money spent and so on. We have to do it because that's the most important thing for developing the programs that will be successful with these students. And that, to me, is why we have to look at it differently, because we have to make sure that we, in fact, are serving them and meeting their needs and reaching the outcomes that are important. Do you have any questions?
Okay. Members have questions? Representative Brining.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Lang, do you think that the fact that the federal government has now apparently offering the value-added growth model for NCLB will help at all, or don't you see that as much of a factor for what we're discussing in this?
Sure. And, of course, it's in the beginning stages of seeing how that actually is going to play out. I think I do think it will help. I think it will help for a couple of reasons. One is just from a philosophical point of view, an acceptance that looking at growth is an important piece. But I think the caveat I'll put on that is that I still believe very strongly that when we do that, that when you have schools that are open 12 months out of the year, you have schools that often students are coming and going because of many different life situations, that we need to look at that growth with a broader view, so that if it's growth from March to March of each year, that isn't going to help you a whole lot. It has to be that we look at it and put some parameters around these programs and say, okay, what happens during the time that student has been enrolled until they exit? And
Mr. Chair, my second question, Dr. Lang, is with the other two states that you're working with, or any states that you're aware of, have any of the other states come up with any other testing model that we could look to, and has the federal government approved anything different?
I'm not aware of any approval at the federal level. I haven't looked into this in great detail, but I am hoping to. California does seem to have designed some models that are looking specifically for alternative schools, and I don't know the details on that yet. It's fairly new. We just emerged from our research. And there is a website that I will be taking a look at there to see if it does apply to some of the other programs that we're aware of. And in terms of nationally, I'm not sure, frankly, how much on the radar this is at a legislative level in a lot of our states. Our research in the early 2000s and surveying states around the nation, in which we survey all of them and talked with state-level officials, in that study, we found that the role of the alternative school within the accountability system was just not a high priority. And yet it is a very, very fast moving and increasing role in education. So I haven't done anything recently, but I think that the nation would really love to see some leadership coming from somewhere, so it would be wonderful if it was here.
Any other questions? You did say that the report that you were quoting from is not going to become available. Is that correct? Or?
Well, actually, there's been, the life of a researcher is an interesting thing, especially when you have a research firm. We actually were hoping that the latest report we did would have some impact on the new NCLB. That was the intent of it, why we were hired to do this work, so that it could be part of the discussion in Washington. However, all of the main players have left since we were hired, and that makes for a difficult situation. And going through all of the powers that be, we just have received permission to release that hopefully within the next month.
Okay.
So it should be available, and I will certainly send it to the
people. Please do, yes.
It's a synthesis, so it's only about 17 pages. It's okay. Not too bad.
Okay, all right, good. Look forward to reading it. There aren't any other questions, we'll call on our next testifier.
Thank you.
Mark Van Rysen. State your name again for the table. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and representatives, my name is Mark Van Rysen. I'm a PhD candidate in educational psychology at the University of Minnesota and a part-time consultant with Education Evolving. My research focuses on school environments and their impact on student motivation and psychological development. My work and the work of my colleagues and I has appeared in the Journal of School Psychology, the Journal of Comparative Psychology, and the Journal of Youth and Adolescence, which recently accepted my master's thesis for publication. I have presented at a variety of conferences around the country, including those organized by the American Educational Research Association, the Society for Research in Child Development, and the Gates Foundation. I'm especially interested in innovative non-traditional school environments and their ability to address the diverse range of student needs and interests that are found among today's youth. The reason I came to the University of Minnesota was the state's national reputation as a leader in progressive educational innovation and reform. I knew there would be ample opportunity here to explore the impact of innovation on student outcomes, and so far I have not been disappointed. The core of my work is the belief that the school environment, or the school culture, if you prefer, exerts a powerful influence on student performance in school. A large body of research supports this idea, demonstrating that student perceptions of the school environment impact students' willingness to take ownership of their learning and put forth the effort necessary to reach their goals. The key aspects of the school environment that are highlighted in this research include things such as emotional and instrumental support from teachers and peers, the notions of equality and fairness in the school environment, consistently high expectations from teachers, and the opportunity to succeed on your own terms rather than in competition with others. My research demonstrates that these aspects of the school environment, in addition to enhancing motivation and educational attainment, also influence psychological development. I have assembled a set of instruments from educational research that assesses these aspects of the school environment. The measure of psychological development that I have chosen for my research is the Dispositional Hope Scale, developed by clinical psychologists at the University of Kansas. As a result, my research project has taken on the name of the HOPE Study. The Dispositional Hope Scale measures an individual's belief in him or herself as a success, a problem solver, and an achiever. Research suggests that hope is a stable dispositional trait that results from experiences in early childhood. Children who are encouraged to set their own goals and persevere to overcome roadblocks, and who are supported in their goal-directed striving by those closest to them, will come to believe that they can achieve whatever they set out to do. Most often, this sort of support and encouragement starts in the home. However, my research demonstrates that school environments can also promote growth in student hope. The aspects of the school environment that I highlighted can contribute to higher levels of student engagement and ownership for learning, which in turn promotes more goal-directed striving. In this way, students can develop a track record of success that promotes growth in hope. Such experiences are especially important for at-risk children who may not have the most supportive goal-directed home environment. By working to promote student hope, schools can realize benefits in terms of student behavior, attendance, and academic achievement, and students gain an increased confidence in themselves that can benefit them throughout their lifespan. Research shows that higher hope students not only set more challenging goals for themselves when compared to lower hope students, but also tend to perceive that they will be more successful. Higher hope students have greater chances of success in college, are more likely to graduate, and report more optimism about life, more physical health, and less anxiety and depression. The HOPE Study treats growth and hope as an important educational outcome. Data are collected directly from students and analyzed year over year to measure not only change in hope, but also the aspects of the school environment that can promote growth and hope. In this way, the HOPE study serves as not only an alternative outcome measure, but also as a tool for school and staff improvement. There are numerous examples across the state of Minnesota in which HOPE study results have opened the eyes of educators and spurred positive change in a variety of settings. Both charter and district-run schools, urban and rural schools, brick-and-mortar online schools, and schools within and outside the state of Minnesota. This fall, with the support of the Blandon Foundation, the HOPE study was expanded to include a dozen rural high schools across the state of Minnesota that have a significant achievement gap between white and minority students. We'll work with these schools to identify the key impediments to their success, devise a plan of action, and obtain resources necessary to close the gap. As a core component of the project, the HOPE study will be used as a diagnostic tool to pinpoint the ways in which the new resources can be most profitably applied. Those of us involved in the HOPE study are not alone in the effort to promote alternative measures. For example, the Center on Educational Governance at the University of Southern California has developed a series of measures that include student, staff, and parental satisfaction. The High School Survey of Student Engagement was developed by researchers in the School of Education at Indiana University. And researchers at Minneapolis's own Search Institute have created the concept of developmental assets, many of which are relevant in the school context. The popularity of these instruments and others like them illustrates the commonly held belief that there is more to success in school and more that schools can do for students than just test scores. To summarize, regardless of location, demographics, or governance, any school can benefit.
We are currently done testing the life safety system, so the drills will not be going off anymore.
That's a relief.
I apologize for that, Mr. Risen. You may continue.
No problem. I'm used to that. To summarize, any school can benefit by taking into account student perceptions of the school environment. By providing greater levels of emotional and instrumental support, by promoting a culture of equality and fairness, by maintaining high expectations, and by providing the students the ability to succeed on their own terms, schools can reverse the often seen downward trends and motivation and engagement, and encourage growth and hope among their students. In such an effort, the HOPE study or measures like it can be used to assess how the school environment is viewed by the students themselves, since their reaction will determine whether the school is successful. It's often said that schools will emphasize that which is measured, or in other words, teaching to the test. If this is so, then the students of Minnesota would undoubtedly benefit from an expansion of the current accountability framework to include alternative measures like the HOPE study. I'm assuming you have a copy of that, so you can see that the remarks are concluded. I'd be happy to field any questions that you might have.
Members have any questions?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Van Rysen.
Not Dr. yet.
Okay, candidate. Okay,
in
soon
spring,
to be.
Hopefully.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure it will come soon with this excellent work. So you're working with the rural schools, and you're envisioning this to be in addition to the testing that's already done and not in place of it, because we hear from the schools already that they're doing so much testing that it takes away from their instructional time. So how does this test work, and so that it doesn't take away from instructional time, and why wouldn't you be wanting to supplant some of the other testing?
You're exactly right in assuming that this would be a broadening of the framework rather than a replacement for academic measures. Several of the aspects of the HOPE study were developed specifically to address those kinds of issues, because we have encountered those in the past several years, one of which is the fact that it's all done online, and it's all done anonymously from my perspective, and it's very, very short-term. It has a very small footprint, once or twice a year, depending upon a student's particular situation, and about 30 or 40 minutes at a time. And it's also very flexible in that it doesn't have to take place on a certain day, or even a certain week for that matter. So schools have discretion in terms of how and when they run students through. And we found that to be those kinds of arrangements to be very well received at the school level. In addition to that, schools tend to, the schools we work with have found a great deal of value in the numbers. Many times, teachers or staff will admit some surprise to seeing some numbers, or perhaps they will reflect further and decide that they have heard comments like that from the student body before. It's really an interesting exercise in triangulation, in trying to understand better what your school culture really is like. And the schools that take advantage of this opportunity, I think, are open to the idea that they don't know everything about their school, and they're willing to learn more, especially from the students, who are, in fact, are the most important components.
I'm curious about the importance of the school design being more student-oriented, should I say, or, I mean, it sounds like it would be helpful in this, with this tool, if teachers are really interested in what students think and would be motivated to make changes based on what the students tell them.
Yep.
How do you see this working in a structure where perhaps that isn't the case, where the school might not be so flexible to hearing what students have to say?
We have dealt with that issue. We've worked in a number of district-run schools, quite traditional in nature. You're definitely correct in assuming that more innovative student-centered schools will score higher, but there is absolutely no reason why a district-run school in a traditional format couldn't also benefit. We've seen different kinds of district-run schools scoring in different ways, and staff there being interested in different kinds of reforms or innovations to try and address areas of weakness. So you're absolutely right in assuming that an interest in student perspectives is a prerequisite to really getting value out of this. That's absolutely true. But that being said, there's no reason why district-run schools with more traditional structures can't benefit also. Interventions exist that can address any of these areas that I've highlighted that would fit right in with a traditional district-run school. For example, programs of peer tutoring happen in the classroom and have been shown to enhance perceptions of support from your peers, and that's something that we measure, and that does contribute to motivation, engagement, and therefore to growth in student hope.
Have you ever encountered a school being somewhat threatened by things that you uncover? Or?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You really have to tread lightly sometimes when you're dealing with these results, because they aren't always positive. The best you can do is to hope, I guess, that the people you're working with, the staff, are professional and are willing to really seriously look at how they do things and are open to change. I think how you present it oftentimes determines how it's achieved, and in that way I try and be very, very careful and very respectful in the environments that I do go into. And I do try and talk as often as possible about the fact that no school is perfect, and that every school can promote a more positive school culture. There isn't any school in the country that wouldn't benefit from knowing more about their culture and to trying to enhance it in various ways. So I think in a lot of cases the idea of continuous improvement and the idea of taking culture seriously and tracing a direct link between culture and student performance is really something that hasn't been considered in schools before. And it does initially encounter resistance in a lot of cases, but in many of those cases, it is seen to be a positive undertaking by the time the discussions are completed.
Representative Lane.
You're doing a work to basically verify that these things, well, exactly what is your research? So I'm wondering if you have been able to correlate an increase in these areas with an increase in academics.
Right, that's a very, very important question. The research that I am referring to in here that exists in the educational arena points to the importance of these environmental aspects in terms of promoting academic achievement and promoting motivation and engagement and those kinds of things. My specific research is on linking these cultural aspects of the school to psychological development. That's where my enhancement to the existing research comes in. With the schools that we've worked with, we have also attempted to get them to provide test scores with the idea that we would try and link some of the growth in psychological development to test scores in the school among the student bodies. But we haven't been all that successful in that effort yet for obvious reasons. Schools sometimes are reluctant to disclose that. It involves a certain amount of effort that schools are not always willing to undertake. So within my own research, I haven't been able to necessarily draw the line between growth and hope and student achievement. However, there is a great deal of research on hope itself that does draw that line. So I'm confident that if I was able to get the data that I was seeking, I would be able to make those linkages.
I would just add the comment that even as it stands on its own, these students are probably in these non-traditional school environments because of psychological development functions, and
right.
By addressing the environment that supports that, you are doing a service. The school would be doing a service for them at that level, for sure.
Absolutely. Not only though have we've been not only in innovative environments, but also in very traditional environments. Just to emphasize that, and that we have found within traditional environments, we have found a great variety of results. Some. Just because a school has hallways and classrooms and lockers doesn't necessarily mean that it's not going to do well in something like this. There's quite a variety of different approaches out there. So school culture, to me, isn't tied so closely to what a school looks like, but more towards more tied closely to what kind of people are in it and how they operate.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Rysen, are these results shared with the community, and how do the parents and the community feel about this? Sometimes we feel at the legislature that we have conservatives that often show up and want reading, writing, and arithmetic, and as soon as you start talking about hope or psychological development or things, we get a little bit of pushback that's mm-hmm. something that should be done in the schools. You wouldn't hear that from the three legislators here. But I'm wondering where this is being done, how it's received by the community.
The results that we come up with are presented to the school, and the school is free to do with it what they please. But in anticipation of those kinds of things, I always try to emphasize with them that this is not meant to supplant academics, but it's actually meant to enhance academics. Higher hope students are more likely to do well in school. They're more likely to set higher goals. They're more likely to strive to overcome roadblocks. I don't see these as being competitors. I see them as being complementary. So that's what I try and emphasize with students and with the staff that I work with. And in addition, the fact that the data gathering that we do is very small in its footprint is also, to me, a strength. There is a way to get a very good view of your school culture without really taking away instructional time.
So, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Rysen, you haven't had any concerns at all expressed by any communities or any parents?
Like I said, I present these data to the schools, and what they do with them is their own choice. I haven't been involved in any situations where I presented this to the community. Mm-hmm. But like I said, people have mentioned to me at schools that they would like to do this, and so I always try and prepare them with this idea that this isn't anything that is taking away from academics, but in fact it's meant to promote academics.
Certainly, in my experience working in alternative schools, what you're saying is borne out. And students who don't believe they can learn or don't believe they have a future, academic or otherwise, find it very difficult to succeed in school or for school to matter. Addressing those concerns or those issues is a problem in those kinds of schools, and it's really good to see your work that you're addressing that. There are different types of schools that call themselves alternatives that may or may not be receptive to student input. I'm thinking also of correctional institutions where
right.
trying to keep control or in some senses to silence student voices is a concern. Have you done any work in that area with correctional institutions or
I have not, but I would be interested in doing that if the opportunity arose. That sounds very intriguing.
Okay. And I, on the other side too, I would say in traditional schools I've been in, there are certain cultures that exist in traditional schools that would be, I think, quite open to mm-hmm. having students be involved and have input. So, as you say, it does work in both areas. Any other questions from members? Okay. Well, thank you very much for your
thank you.
And the additional information that you gave us on the study.
Thanks very much.
Any comments from members? Or okay, all right. Our next presenter is Brian Lassiter. Would you come forward, please? And please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. I'm Brian Lassiter, President of the Minnesota Council for Quality. I do have a copy of a transcript of my notes that I'll give to somebody when you're ready. Minnesota Council for Quality is a 20-year-old nonprofit organization originally founded in the state of Minnesota back in 1987 under the Purpich administration. We were spun off into a 501c3 in 1989. The mission of our organization is to help all types of organizations around the state improve their performance with each higher levels of excellence. We work with leaders within organizations to identify the strengths and improvement opportunities so that they can focus their energy and resources on the right things. We also build networks that bring information, resources, knowledge, and best practices to organizations desiring to improve. On the latter, we operate an online improvement clearinghouse that brokers information on organizational excellence, an online consultant referral network to broker experts, virtual and physical knowledge forums, such as our performance improvement networks that offer forums for leaders to come together and share knowledge and information on organizational excellence. And we have alliances with over a dozen other nonprofits that focus on organizational excellence. We have nearly 300 members representing about 150,000 employees in and beyond the state of Minnesota. Most of our work is accomplished through a network of over 150 volunteers, many of whom give over 100 hours of service a year to helping organizations improve their performance. Our core service is the Minnesota Quality Award, which is this state's version of the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. We're one of 37 state quality award programs modeled after the national award. The Baldrige program was created by an act of Congress in 1987 to improve the performance and the competitiveness of U.S. corporations. It was primarily used by manufacturers in the late 80s and early 90s. In the early to mid-90s, it was begun to be used by service sector businesses. In the last 5 to 10 years, the increase of frequency of use with non-businesses, including healthcare organizations, educational institutions, both K-12 and higher ed, and not-for-profit organizations, including nonprofits, public sector agencies, government. The reasons an organization would use Baldrige are to identify their strengths and improvement opportunities, to facilitate improvement, alignment, and integration, to assist in the delivery of value to the stakeholders, and to facilitate organizational and personal learning. Though recognition is important, it is certainly secondary to the learning and improvement of results that come with the use of the framework. Baldrige is a framework. It's a management system that comprises of 6 interrelated process categories and 1 comprehensive results category. I see you have some materials in front of you, the Baldrige booklet with the criteria. The process categories include leadership, strategic planning, customer and market focus, or in the language of education, that's student, stakeholder, and market focus, measurement analysis and knowledge management, workforce focus, process management, and Category 7 is results. Category 7 is further broken into 6 different areas of results, outcomes, if you will, that all organizations, including educational institutions, should be monitoring and managing to improve overall performance. These areas represent a balanced scorecard, if you will, a comprehensive set of metrics that organizations are using to measure their performance. Under the categories are a set of validated criteria that Baldrige calls the criteria for performance excellence. These criteria have been demonstrated to produce excellent organizational results in all types of organizations. In this way, the criteria have become to represent a set of evidence-based best practices that all organizations can gauge their own performance against. The framework is systemic in that it represents the system's view of an organization. Like an automobile or a human body, I suppose. The systemic framework helps leaders understand the connectedness and the interrelationships of all the processes and operations of an organization so that they can optimize resources, align their different processes, and improve performance results. Using the framework allows organizations to systematically stay current with the environment, internal and external, and continuously identify and improve gaps in its system, and to use data to make decisions rather than intuition. Organizations using the Baldrige framework typically conduct an assessment of their operations to identify strengths and improvement opportunities that they can focus their management attention on, their organizational energy, and their enterprise's resources. Assessments can be performed by the organization itself in a self-assessment format or by a third party through our organization, the Baldrige National Program, or any number of consultants that are trained and expert in the framework. These assessments are comprehensive and rigorous, focusing on all aspects of the enterprise's performance. They are designed to evaluate performance through an organization's unique set of factors, and in this way, the insights and the feedback are tailored to the organization's environment and circumstances. But all assessments do use the Baldrige criteria for performance excellence as the foundation for determining what's working well and what might be candidates for improvement. In our Minnesota Quality Award process, we use a cadre of trained volunteer evaluators to evaluate organizations against these criteria. Our process has four stages. An independent review, in which a team of evaluators form an independent opinion of strengths and improvement opportunities of an organization. Consensus, in which a team of 6-9 evaluators reach a collective view of the strengths and improvement opportunities of the organization. Site visit, in which the team validates these strengths and improvement opportunities. And an improvement planning session with senior leaders of the organization, in which the team presents their findings and helps the leaders identify and prioritize actions to take to close the gap. Most organizations will use this process as one of many inputs into their planning process, helping them make resource allocation decisions and monitor progress of their improvement efforts. The assessment and the Baldrige frameworks are scalable. It's being used by large, complex, multinational corporations like Boeing and Motorola and the Mayo Clinic here in the state, as well as by nonprofits, schools, and small businesses. And we'll hear in a minute from a teacher within Chaska High School that's used it with his two-person classroom. The concepts of systemic evaluation and continuous improvement can be applied to an enterprise, to a division or department or unit of an enterprise, to a facility or site, or to an alternative program as we're discussing today. There's much evidence of the value of the use of this framework. I'll offer two pieces of evidence, first in the business setting and then move to education. One study performed twice in the 90s, in the early 90s and then repeated in the late 90s, was conducted by two professors, one from Georgia Tech and one from the College of William and Mary. They studied 600 organizations among several different performance dimensions, including growth in the stock price, sales, operating income, total assets, and growth in employees. 300 of these organizations had won a Baldrige-based award, and 300 were a control group of non-award-winning companies. And in every single case, the award-winning cadre of organizations outperformed their peers. A second example is a locally based mutual fund owned by top financial advisors in Edina. It created a Q100 index, Q for quality, and what they've tried to do is isolate the top 100 managed corporations of the S&P 500 and using Baldrige as the framework to do that. The premise is that better managed organizations will produce better results over time. So far, they've outperformed the index in aggregate since 1998. There have been four K-12 recipients of the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award and three higher education recipients. Pearl River School Districts out of New York, Chugach Schools in Alaska, which represents a very non-traditional K-12 district in Alaska, Jenks Public Schools in Jenks, Oklahoma, Community Consolidated School District 15, Palatine, Illinois, and the three higher ed recipients are University of Wisconsin-Stout, down the road in Menominee, the Kenneth W. Montfort College of Business in Colorado Springs, and Richland College in Dallas, Texas. When I submit my transcript, I'll have you review several different performance metrics, outcomes, if you will, from these education institutions, some of them academic and some of them non-academic, that demonstrates the value of this framework in improving results. The use of Baldrige in Minnesota continues to increase in education and outside of education. since our award's inception in 1991, there have been 88 recipients of the Minnesota Quality Award. We anticipate recognizing 9 organizations in this current 2007 cycle. We recognized 8 last year, and we expect 12 to 15 organizations to apply for our award in 2008. Businesses are still using the Baldrige framework, but a growing number of healthcare providers, education institutions, and nonprofits are using the framework as well. In fact, we estimate approximately 20 to 25 K-12 school districts in the state of Minnesota are using Baldrige as the basis for their improvement efforts. About half of them are part of the Rochester and Math and Science Partnership, a nonprofit group in southeast Minnesota, using Baldrige and other quality tools to measure and improve the performance in math, science, technology, and overall academic performance. Many are seeing significant gains in terms of their academic achievement and non-academic outcomes. With that, Mr. Chair and Representative, I invite your questions.
Okay. Do the members have questions? Mr. Lassiter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lassiter, who are the volunteers that get trained and do this, and what inspires them to work 100 hours? Are they doing it as an offshoot of their own job and get some brownie points for that, or is there some other motivation? And then, why do the schools that have been involved get involved? Do you recruit them, or do they find out about it and come and speak to you, or how does that work?
I'll start with the first set of questions first. Our evaluators really do represent the diversity of the economy. There are numerous senior-level leaders, mid-level managers, individual contributors. We have quality practitioners. We have a growing number of non-business folks. We have superintendents and administrators and school teachers. We have healthcare providers, we have physicians and surgeons and RNs. It's a really diverse group of folks. They all have different motivations for getting involved, but the common thread is that they're interested in organizational excellence and improving the state of Minnesota. Many of them, most of them, are employed by an employer, and so their employer supports their time and their investment in terms of professional growth and the benefits of their organization. But some of others are self-employed and view this as an opportunity to increase their skill sets and their networks and really grow professionally as well as help other organizations along their journey. I really believe these individuals are heroes. They give a lot of themselves, a lot of their time, a lot of their expertise to not only help themselves and their organizations improve, but to help other types of organizations throughout the state improve. The school districts that get involved do so on their own accord. They come to us, quite honestly. We have sales and outreach and marketing efforts, but all organizations that come through our process are voluntary, and their senior leaders have agreed or have recognized that this framework helps improve outcomes, improve results, and so the only reason why they would go through this is to learn more about themselves, to see how they compare to this set of best practices, and to identify opportunities for improvement.
Mr. Chair.
Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Lassiter. Do you find that the ones that self-select then are already pretty good? I toured that. I'm from Rochester, and so I toured actually my old high school this past fall and happened to stumble upon some of the Rochester Math and Science Project.
Yes. It was
very impressive. And but I'm wondering about like alternative type schools, and you've heard the demographics that people are talking about that we're covering in this committee. Have you started out with some that really needed some improvement, and then they improve through the topics that are here, or are you evaluating ones that are pretty good already?
All over the continuum, to be honest. Some organizations have in place many quality and continuous improvement frameworks before ever coming to us, and they want to gauge how good they are, and to systematically and through data find opportunities for further improvement, using the analogy, stealing the analogy from Jim Collins, to get from good to great. Others, however, are very early in their journey of trying to improve performance. We've worked with education and other types of organizations that are less sophisticated, less mature, and have more obvious gaps in their system. The beauty of the Baldrige framework is that not only is it scalable, but it's fairly customized to the organization's level of maturity. And so the opportunities that come through this assessment really do represent where they are in their performance. the more basic fundamentals of business or organizational improvement will come forth first. And once you solve those as an organization, then your next set of opportunities get a little more complex and a little more sophisticated. Because this does work with all types of organizations.
And then, Mr. Chair, one final question.
Ms. Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Lassiter. Have you noticed any correlation with schools that are using the alternative compensation model being interested in this?
Only one, to my knowledge, right now. It's Marshall Public Schools. Just recently completed our evaluation. Just in fact, last week we had that improvement planning session, which was the outreach for senior leaders, and they're a QComp district, one of the earlier ones. I'm not sure about any of the Ramp school districts down in southeast Minnesota, if any of them are using QComp. Marshall's the only one that comes to mind. And Marshall views this as a way to not only improve academic performance and student achievement with all of their students, but also as a way to engage the workforce, to motivate faculty and staff and to help them become more capable in achieving their mission and helping students achieve. So it's very aligned, I think, with the QComp method.
Mr. Lassiter, with your experience and knowledge about quality improvement, would you care to comment on what your opinion of the system we use now with the regime of testing, and will that get us to quality or quality improvement?
It's a step, for sure, and the gentleman that offered testimony right before me, I think, said it as well as probably I could. I think schools need a triangulation, I think that was the word you used, of methods to gauge performance, and it's not just tests, certainly, and it's not just graduation rates, and it's not just a whole host of other academic measures, but there's a lot of leading indicators for performance improvement, too, and some of them have nothing to do with academics on the surface, but have everything to do with workforce engagement and culture and capabilities of your staff and the satisfaction of not only your students but other stakeholders in the community. Certainly financials and leadership and other types of dimensions. And so when you wrap all those together, it certainly goes way beyond test scores. It's about managing the entire system of an organization and trying to push all the different buttons that allow the entire system to be optimized.
And if we're looking at a way to have all schools improve, it seems as though this takes a fair amount of commitment from the organization to really embrace the effort and be informed by it. Have you worked with schools or organizations that are, you know, can take pieces of it and make it work, make something, gain something from it? Or I guess I'm trying to think of how this would apply across the board. But
yes, and Mr. Chair, I do fully appreciate the rigor and the amount of time and investment a system like this requires. My first response is that our Minnesota program, and actually several of the other state programs, have created more entry-level evaluations, and we're piloting one now that will go live in 2008, which hopefully will reduce barriers to entry and allow many more types of organizations to use a framework that is as proven and useful as Baldrige, but not require as much investment and time and resource. That's my first response. My second response is that all seven of those Baldrige categories are in place in all schools and all alternative programs. So it's just a matter of how well they're managed and how well they're producing results. Mm-hmm. And so while you could focus on independent aspects of the system, my advice to any organization, school or otherwise, is to focus on the entire system.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr.
I'm wondering if I
could. Representative Bryan, we had a classroom teacher with
great. Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and representatives, if that's the proper way to address you. My name is Jamie Cornell. I am a chemistry teacher at Chaska High School. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I did and the value of the Baldrige criteria or framework of how I see that as having value to school. So that, I believe, is my piece here. I've taught high school for about 25 years. I am almost licensed as a principal. I'm just about there, so I'm not going to get my PhD, but I will get my license as a high school principal shortly. I have been interested in sort of the systemic organization of schools since I started teaching, and looked at the process that's going on within schools, and been frustrated that it wasn't more integrated and aligned. So I've been looking for ways to make things better in public schools for a long time. About 10 years ago, the district I was in, the Jackson Public Schools, went through a process where we did a Baldrige narrative internally, and we sent the district sent a group of people, the superintendent, assistant superintendents, principals, teachers, parents, school board members, and even students to go through training with the Minnesota Quality Council. And that's where I sort of figured out that the Baldrige criteria existed. Since that time, I have probably been on 15 to 20 evaluations and done the evaluated narratives that people have put together, the assessments that they've done, both within the state and at the national level. You asked Mr. Lasser why people do this. I'm not quite sure. I'm still married, so I guess that's a good sign. It's a huge commitment of time. It's about trying to figure out ways to make things work better. And that's why I do it. I don't know why other people do it. I saw this in action in different levels and was very drawn to the systematic approach that it takes to how an organization is structured. At that point in the late 1990s, I didn't have the ability to impact anything that was going on at the school level, but I did have the ability to impact what was going on in my classroom. So I thought, if I'm evaluating organizations on this, I might as well actually try it on my own organization. So I did this. I took that book that you're looking at and broke that down for my class, my chemistry class, and with a colleague, we went through what we did and took everything in that framework and sort of mapped it on what we do with the intent of trying to look at our organization and figure out ways to make it better. So it was a bit of a stretch and it was a lot of work, but we put it together and had a site visit of, there were six adults that were in our classroom for 2 days, doing a site visit on our narrative and on our organization. What I learned from that is quite a bit about what it takes to help me help my students succeed. And I think that's the value that the alternative schools would get out of this program. It's not just the test score that comes at the end. There are lots of things that go into making this happen. The process of going through the narrative forces the organization to actually do a lot of introspection and say, what is important? What are we trying to get here out of these kids? And what are the things that we can do? What are the interventions that we need to put together to help these kids succeed? And what are the measures? How are we going to know that these things are successful? Within my own classroom, I'm not teaching college prep chemistry so much as I'm teaching chemistry for the masses. So I had to say, all right, with this demographic that I'm working with, what are the things that are important? What am I really trying to do? Well, I'm trying to teach scientific literacy. So what do I need to help these kids learn scientific literacy? I think the same mindset goes with alternative schools. What are they really about there? Well, they're helping these kids succeed. And part of that success is the MCA test, the graduation that comes at the end of it. But there's a whole lot that's embedded in the success of these kids that has to be in place in order for these kids to be successful academically. And the criteria, the Baldrige criteria, this framework, allows you to take a more holistic view and integrate that holistic view into a set of measures that you can then use to gauge the success of your organization and to inform the processes that you're using to help address those needed gains or whatever the issues are that need to be put in place
to help those kids succeed, to help the organization get better at helping those kids succeed. I would hope... Let me back up a second. When I started doing this, I thought, well, this is the way to go. Why don't we just gauge all our schools on this criteria? It's a lot of work. After having done this for 10 years, I have pulled back a little bit on where I think this ought to go in schools. I think that senior leaders ought to understand this, and they ought to incorporate that in how they manage schools. I'm not sure that the average classroom teacher needs to be able to recite the seven categories of Baldrige or get into all the issues that are around that. But it is how the systems ought to be run. And I think if nothing else, the adoption of this criteria as an alternative form of assessment for alternative schools would be an avenue that they could use that would help them not only show that they're being successful, but figure out things that they can do to be more successful internally because of the systematic nature of the criteria. I have been at a couple organizations nationally that have won the award. I've been part of the assessment teams. I actually got to spend time in Chugach. It was after they won the award, but I got to spend time there. I taught chemistry there for a week during my spring break a few years ago. And they've done amazing things. They have a demographic that was wildly unsuccessful. Their school district covers approximately a third of the geographic area of the state of Minnesota, and they have 240 students. Okay, so just imagine the logistics that go into that. Their graduation rates were less than 50% in the mid-90s. Their test scores were horrific. They had no one that in recent memory that had gone on to higher education. They made a lot of improvement efforts, and at the sort of culmination of these improvement efforts, they looked at the criteria and assessed themselves based on the criteria. They've done outstanding things as far as their results with their kids that I think are as a result of attending to the organizational issues that are in the criteria. It wasn't because of the criteria, but they did the same things that the criteria asked for. And that's the value that I think the schools can gain from it. Actually, going through the assessment is a lot of work. You can learn a lot about the criteria, and a measure of yourself is having someone come in and do an independent outside assessment on the organization. I don't have a copy of a transcript for you to pass out. I could give you my narrative. I did have this group come in and assess my classroom, but I don't know that would be pleasurable reading for you. So, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fennell, you mentioned, I asked the last person, did he see it as an alternative test, and he said it would be in addition to the current testing, but you said an alternative form of assessment. So you're seeing this as would it be in place of the current regimen of tests or in addition to the way you envision it?
I'm not entirely certain what they're gauged on right now. I see this as a more holistic measure. I would imagine that the state assessments, the required state assessments, would still be a part of that holistic measure. But part of the criteria, part of what the criteria asks for is what is important in the organization So showing gains within the populations and the demographics that these schools are working with would be an indicator of their value. So do they have worth? Are they meeting a need? If they can transition kids from one point to another and put them back into another system, that's not necessarily going to show a graduation rate, but there are pieces of that that have value that would be captured through an assessment such as this that would help inform whether these organizations are being successful or not. So I guess I don't see it as being a replacement. I see it as an addition to, there are a lot of things that need to be taken into account in an alternative assessment or alternative school settings. An example or
an analogy. In a prison school, and you've got kids in juvenile detention, you don't shut down the school if the kids aren't graduating. I mean, it's a necessary component to what those kids are having. I think the alternative schools provide a service for a group of students that aren't getting their needs met in traditional settings. So a gauge of their success is how well are they meeting the needs of these kids. They do have to pass the state test. They do have to learn how to read. They do have to learn how to write. These things are going to be, I would hope the alternative schools would be moving these kids towards that end, but the actual culmination of that may not be the sole measure or the necessary measure of the success of the alternative schools. Does that answer the question?
One of the things that I find sufficient in the regimen of testing that we have is it doesn't necessarily lead a principal or a teacher or administrator to say, what do I do now that I know my students are either not doing so well or doing great? And I think systemic interventions or measures, you're assuming that you want to improve things whether they're going really well or not. And because of the way that you look at things, you're informing yourself about what you can do to improve. And if tests only tell us either that we're doing okay or that students aren't doing well without helping us understand why, it's difficult to make that, you know, improvement. So I, thinking more about the question that you were just asked, you know, if the tests are part of a larger, you know, looking at the system itself, it makes sense to do testing. But to do testing in isolation of anything that really looks at what's going on in the school seems not that helpful. Would you have a comment about it?
I would have to agree with that. I am involved with the implementation of the MCA, MCA 2 for science that's going on within our district right now. And in working with the people from the State Department of Education, it has, I don't want to overspeak myself here, but the purpose, as I see it, the main purpose of the MCAs is to gauge how well the school is doing, not necessarily to inform the schools on what they need to do better. And I understand that as there's a value to that, but it's of limited value to us in the trenches because we don't know what to do better. I think something like the Baldrige criteria, a more holistic approach to assessment, has much more value to the people that are trying to improve. The state tests as they are now mostly say, yes, you made it, or no, you didn't, or this is the level that you made it at. It doesn't necessarily tell us what we need to do to improve. The fuller criteria, such as the Baldrige criteria, will allow you to get a lot of leading indicators to look at the assessments that you're doing in a much more holistic and integrated manner. So how are the things that we're doing here affecting outcomes that are essential? I mean, it is important that kids learn how to read and write, but what are the things that we can do and do better to help that outcome eventually? So I think that addresses
the I'm also curious about the school in Alaska that you mentioned, and quite a challenging job they have to educate a relatively small group of students over a wide area. I guess what I'm thinking about is when they looked or when they used this criteria, did it cause them to make fundamental changes in the way and what they were doing? And what kind of school did they have and what kind of school did they end up with?
Right. Chugach is a little is unique in their use of the Baldrige. They'd already done all the improvements, so they had a wonderful cadre of people that had sort of accidentally come together at Chugach, and they were working on lots of things. They made huge fundamental changes in how they approach things, but it wasn't as a result of using the criteria, it matched what the criteria called for. So there was a coincidental nature of it. They won the award first time out of the chute because they'd done everything that was already in the award as how they made their improvement efforts. Could that be a roadmap for other schools? Absolutely. I mean, following the criteria, the essence of the criteria, the organizational alignment and integration, attending to stakeholders, what do your parents need, what do your students need, what does the community need, those things drive fundamental changes within the organization. So what's buried in there is not, it's not unique to the Baldrige criteria, but the criteria pulls it all together into a framework that sort of gives a blueprint to how to address, how to become aware of and address the needs of the groups that you're trying to serve.
Another thought that I'm thinking about is we hear a lot about reform in schools and how schools ought to be reformed, and not necessarily that we want to change schools entirely, but would the Baldrige method be a way of just telling us how to improve the schools we've got and the structures, and or could they possibly also lead us to better understand what kind of schools we really ought to have?
They've been used both ways. Some of the national winners, I think, are more focused on incremental improvements, which is, here's what we've got, how do we tweak it and make it better and better and better. Places like Chugach have taken and said, this isn't working, what are we going to do different? And use the criteria, the same set of criteria, to come to a very different end. So it can be used for both. Organizations will just try to improve what they're doing, and some organizations will look at what they're doing or not doing as well as they would like to and use the criteria to drive fundamental changes.
Okay. Another question?
I'm thinking, you've stirred my thinking around when I was on a school board, was when I was talking about results-oriented education, saying that look at the results you want, therefore then you have to ask, but how will you measure to know if you've gotten them, therefore how will you get there? It'll all be driven like that. And as we look at alternative schools and some of the urban settings, we're basing them all on the results that we wanted in a traditional setting. Before we would just have traditional schools with traditional students, and the others would sort of, other children would sort of fade away and fade into the, you know, we didn't worry about them. Now we're saying educate all students, so we end up with huge challenges in the urban setting and in the alternative schools popping up and charter schools of all sorts. If the alternative schools meet kids that aren't successful in traditional high schools, then we need to ask, why aren't they successful in that parameter, and how do we help them? It just strikes me that when we say results-oriented, the results need to be addressing the particular students. It can't be just one pot of this is the result. The results are such and such a grade on math and English, you know, and that's it. And those are the results you want, and why aren't you getting them? But if alternative schools are having kids that aren't successful in the traditional programs, why aren't they successful? It drives all kinds of things, like we heard from the other, the HOPE project. How do we get them in a situation where they then can be successful, and that would drive what we do with them? So you're suggesting that this is one program that could answer the question of if problem is, for instance, psychological development maturity, so that they can learn and live, how do we measure that? Therefore, how do we drive change in the institution to have that, so that they can then have the other? It's much more in depth. A very simple-minded, these are the results, will lead to the high-stake tests. A larger understanding of what the results are that we want will open the door to such things as this.
I agree. I would argue that we need more alternatives instead of this is what Chaska High School does. It's here are the things that Chaska High School does, and here's how you can fit. So it's focused on what are the student needs with some sort of outside measure of what does it look like to be successful. And, you know, we could cumulatively come to a picture of what success means and help put structures in place to help these kids become successful. And alternative schools certainly do that. part of the criteria is helping to understand what are the needs of the people that you're trying to serve. So what are the needs of these students, and how would we gauge whether we're being successful in helping those kids gain those things?
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. Very interesting. I'm a little curious if Mr. Lydell would come forward and maybe Mr. Allen. From what we've heard so far in the testimony this evening, are there things that that we've heard or that you've heard that you'd like to either comment on or tell us how you, in your opinion, how might these things work in the settings that you've worked in? And if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Terry Lydell, President of the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. If I heard your question right, Representative Bly, the systemic stuff of the Baldrige is really, to me, the real obvious example of what it is that we have been talking about to this point in time with this work group. And that is that we have to look at everything that happens within the alternative program. We take whoever comes in the door, and when they leave with a diploma, that they leave with some value added to their lives. That we have to measure as close to the leading edge as we can, the leading indicators, and the formative evaluations along the way, and not just have ourselves judged on the final high-stakes tests that really do not inform us of anything.
Representative Bly and committee members, my name is Steve Allen. I'm the president-elect of Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. My reflections here is what you have put forth in these three sessions has been some really super testimony. And I just really wish that this could have been shared with your colleagues, because you have been educated with some people who really shine. I mean, and to present multiple means of assessing schools and assessing kids in a comprehensive manner and doing it that has value and meaning is really what you've been addressing in these three sessions. And you've led it all the way from trying to understand in your first round to understanding what these kids look like, to what some of the programs look like, to what some of these multiple assessments can be. You know, I didn't think that when Mr. Lydell and Representative Bly put this together that they could, quite frankly, I didn't think that they could educate the legislators because of the comprehensiveness of this need. And it's hard to tell people, traditional people, that we need to look at assessments beyond reading and writing. That we need to look at the affective needs of the kids. We need to look at the learning environment. How powerful those things are. I can promise you that when you walk into a school and you can feel when there is a healthy feeling tone that enhances learning. And how do you measure that? And Cheryl Lang has been around a long time, and we go way back, and she's been preaching this for a long time. You know, you've had pretty powerful testimony, and I think the challenge now is whether or not you can convince your colleagues. I really do, because you're onto something in my mind that's pretty special. And you are the leading indicator for other legislators, because around the state, around the nation, it's not happening. And, you know, you are challenging some real core assumptions.
Questions? Representative Bryson.
Either Mr. Lydell or Mr. Allen, when we had the profile of learning, did you think that that did a better job of what you're getting at, or are you wanting something different than that as well?
Well, I think the profile was onto something. One of the major issues that I've seen repeated in my time in education, I just recently retired after 30 plus years, is that there are some good ideas to start with, but they many times are followed by meddling in the professional practice of the people we hire to be in the classroom. So, some standards, I guess the best way to say it is that at any point in time when the legislature says, this is what we want our schools to produce, they should turn around and say to the teachers, go do that, and leave it lie there. We shouldn't have the bureaucracy of the state of Minnesota stepping in all the time, meddling. Was that strong enough?
Representative Grayling, Mr. Chairman, and committee members, I would like to support what Mr. Lightdale said. I remember very vividly standing outside a Capitol Square building before they demolished it with Dr. Wayne Jennings after the profile was introduced. And Wayne had a checklist of assessments. I remember this day. I said, Wayne, do you remember when you pulled that checklist out and showed me all these assessments that you would like to use for kids? And all of a sudden, it started to be meddled with. And all of a sudden, it was being locked into a standardized format. And all of a sudden, our options were eliminated.
I would like to, if I may, go back and take a look at the fact that what we have been talking about here is a group of people who are defined in law as having to be in school in a certain place. They have to meet one of 12 criteria. So we've set aside very specifically a challenging situation, because we have students who have anything in the world going on in their life, things that are beyond their maturity level really to deal with, and ask them also to go about getting an education. And in talking with Cheryl Lang about this, she's rather excited to see, from a researcher's viewpoint, what really could we do, because she is convinced by the research that she has done and seen, and she is very much aware of the HOPE study, she's aware of the Baldrige approach, she knows our students intimately. She is excited to see, could we move forward with these students and create schools that we know will be successful? So in other words, we have talked amongst ourselves in MAP and with other stakeholders in education, and we would like to have the opportunity for the profession to practice. We have a profession, we'd like to have a practice with that, to see if we can't set aside as a pilot study, for instance, a group of students, a group of schools, and apply the principles that you've heard about, the concepts that you've heard about, to see if we can't make this successful. Because as you've heard from MDE, there's a whole lot of data we don't have yet. If we are internally evaluating ourselves, we will have that data. We will be able to say that this is what we want to do, and we're going to measure what matters. And at any point in time, we should be able to say exactly where we're at without having to depend on such things as we don't have the computing power for that, or kids move around too much. So we have an opportunity here, I think, to set aside a group of people to do something that we believe very strongly, because we've worked on it for so many years, that it could be meaningful for the students.
Reading into a little bit about what you're saying, so are you, would it be your recommendation that the legislature find some way to allocate some funds or the ability, at any rate, for a few schools to experiment with this kind of assessment, or to see whether or not they could produce some results that would inform the legislature that this would be something to look into, something to go forward with? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, but anything takes money. I understand the state's about $380 some million short right now, but Money would not be the major driver of it. Yes, there's going to be some money. That kind of money would primarily be spent on the housekeeping, but primarily on staff development. The major thing that we would need, more important than money, would be the autonomy to actually practice, put into practice these things without being restricted by state or local bureaucracy. So autonomy to function would be imperative. Much like IBM had to do to create the PC, or much like General Motors had to do to create the Saturn. They shipped some people off to a distant place and said nobody talk to them until they come back with a PC or they come back with a Saturn. We just have to break the concept that the bureaucracy that we have built cannot recreate itself, cannot be innovative. We need to just step some people out aside and let them go for it.
Do you have a sense that there are schools that would step forward and want to do this, or are already doing something like this?
Representative Bly, our schools really are not afraid of accountability, and we want to get better. And I think some of the things that we've demonstrated, we created our own Deming roundtable that we did ourselves, hired our own consultants. We did that. Some of us have been involved in some of the quality council evaluations. I think that we definitely want to get better, and we want to improve, but we want to do it in a meaningful fashion.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I know there are two or three other alternative educators here. Do you have any wish to come forward and make a comment on what you've heard? You don't have to. I'm just giving you the opportunity. Okay. All right. Anyone else like to make some comments? Mr. Colbury, I see that you're here. Would you like to comment on what you've heard today?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mentioned before that we have a report coming through that I think does build on this, but I'd like to send it to you first.
Okay.
And let you see if you think it would be appropriate for that fourth and final meeting.
Okay. All right. Well, is there any other commenters or comments from the members here? I think we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you for your attendance.